Hello, everybody. The following is a recorded discussion of the Daily Maxims and More for January 5th, 2011. We discussed those on January 7th, 2011. And today we went over property rights and possession.
Property by Charles A. Wiseman, page 6 and 7. The term property, this term includes the obvious physical and tangible things, such as tools, cars, house furniture, food, merchandise, land minerals, natural resources, and animals. But it can also include intangible things as well. Thus, property also includes the following. A contract is property to the parties involved. A transferable award, a license, a coupon, a ticket. Anything possessing value that everyone acknowledges has value. Then you get further. You got the name, the reputation, goodwill. The labor of an individual is property. And that's so you can apply the same kind of rules to the labor. A person's business, profession, trade, or occupation, and all fruits from them constitute property. A bequest and a will is property of the beneficiary. Money, stocks, patents. Any question about any of that, or is it confusing?
What is a coupon?
That can be almost those things you take to the supermarket, or they had things that they sold called coupon bonds. Have you ever heard of them?
Well, maybe a long time ago, but not recently.
I'm sure they still have them, but the highest levels are the most... essentially to be considered probably the most secure negotiations. And they actually came with perforated pieces of tabs that every year you would tear off and send in and get your money for it.
Ah.
That guy sits around all year and just clips coupons.
Okay.
Got it?
Yes.
Property is essentially everything which has an exchange of value.
Oh, value. Yes.
I would actually reverse those words, a value of exchange. Property is essentially everything which has a value of exchange, for exchange. It has a value.
Mm-hmm.
The right of property includes the power to own and possess a property, to dispose of it according to the will of the owner, or to sell it, or to give it away as a gift. It is said that property is older than governments and was a right given by God in the command, "Thou shalt not steal." It also was in the covenant with Abraham. Most people don't go back that far, but in law school, they would, and at some time in the past, they would always teach, the covenant runs with the land. The covenant runs with the land, and land is property.
Mm-hmm.
And what would happen is nobody would really get into what it meant in depth until my mentor he went out and got the Bible one day, and one of the first things he said was, "Hey, that's the Abrahamic covenant. The covenant runs with the land," because he's talking about the land in the nations is going to go to the descendants of Abraham. To dispose according, we thus see that this phrase, life, liberty, and property, is in essence a summation of all that is important to us in the physical world. Everything that can be regarded as something necessary or valuable, the physical mortal beings on earth can be categorized under the phrase life, liberty, and property. Now, the right of life, liberty, and property includes the right to protect each aspect of it. Each aspect it represents from harm, injury, devaluation, or destruction.
Ah. This is really something. I can use everything here in this thing you've read in order to explain things pertaining to the assembly and why people need to get involved.
Yeah.
The common law way of looking at things. This paragraph in here about the right of property includes, is that it's older than government, et cetera. And in the last sentence, the right of property includes the right to protect each aspect of it.
From harm, injury, devaluation, or destruction.
Yeah, that justifies replacing the local government. This is a very good thing. I could really use this.
Well, you see, it's bordering on the common law. Remember, the common law deals with rights and remedies. Why remedies? Well, because it's only we're using it when somebody's rights are being trespassed. And so a trespass would include burning it up, hitting it in the side, and getting the side of it in, you know. It's damages of any kind to either a property or person. And the remedy is to go using the common law and get a remedy for that. But yes, I see your point. Well, excellent. The, you know, some of them say life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But the right of life, liberty, and property. Let's take a moment about liberty. I read the thing last night about the things I'd written about sovereignty. One of the things I didn't get into is a relationship in depth about the Reformation. Now, you may or may not know a lot about the Reformation, but basically, Martin Luther had been a lawyer, was trained, and was walking down the road, and lightning struck a tree
right
next to him. And he said, okay, I'll go become a priest. Anyway, when he became a priest, he had this legal, justice training. And he began to notice how in the church, in particular, the Romish church, you know, rights were handled. And it was that's weird. And then indulgences were sold and so on. But he was good enough as a lawyer that he was permitted to read the Bible. Now, until 1966, it was a canonical crime to read the Bible if you were a member of the Catholic Church.
Up until 1 year again, please?
1966, I think it was.
Wow.
You had to let your priest read it and explain it to you. And so this was a thing that Luther just couldn't. Once he understood what it was saying, he realized that they were duping the people, and that's why he did what he did eventually. He was a professor that taught priests, and he began to teach what he was learning from the Bible itself, and it began to create ripples. And finally, he had to do something, and he did, and it became the Reformation. We're reforming the church. And it went. He was able to be successful because of where he was. He was in Germany, and they had a weaker system of political power in which the group of barons was essentially stronger than the key man, the king. And so the barons had to get along with one another to have any system of peace. So it was, compromising or getting along with one another thing. So when they finally got around to what he was about, they got an edict. Now remember, I'm still addressing the term liberty.
Okay.
They got an edict which said, from that point on, that everyone in the church would be permitted to exercise their liberty of conscience.
Ah, great phrase. Excellent, excellent phrase.
Okay.
I can use that phrase also. Let me write that down.
Okay. The liberty of conscience. And that's a very powerful phrase and pretty inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
So, after a couple years of having that effect where people could read the Bible, like Luther was wanting to have them do, and that was the motivation for getting the printing press set up in his era and getting it printed so that people had the copy to read. But it was basically the liberty of conscience, because if you were going to read the Bible, you may come to a different conclusion than the next guy. And up until that time, when you thought something different than the powers that be, when you chose not to believe what they said you must believe, you were categorized as a heretic, which was a crime.
Oh, dear.
So the
please, folks, remind me, I have something to say when you're all finished.
Okay. Now, the crime was you were thinking for yourself. You were not thinking what you were being told to think. Now, recognize that the system had grown. This is 1,500 years into, you know, the era after Jesus had walked the earth.
Yes.
Where we had, and then Adam had total liberty, freely to eat from any tree. He could choose. He had the power to choose to disobey God. Now, at the end of his life, he would suffer, but in the meantime, I mean, it was the right that he had.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and therefore, the liberty had degenerated to where you had none. And it was worse than that. Don't do as I do as I say. Now, when the edict was announced, and there's names for these things, and I forgot them, the edict of Worms or, you know, something like that. Anyway, it lasted for 2 years. And so then the church decided, well, it's been long enough. Let's go repeal it. So they came into Germany and went to the guy in charge who was referred to as an elector in these matters. But he was the kind of the boss. And then he was asked by the church to set up and engage in a convention or assembly in which they would repeal that very edict and liberty of conscience would be no more. They figured they'd waited long enough to be able to pull it off. Well, the barons went, hey, wait a minute. And they had become great believers in the things that Luther was teaching. They grasped it, and they saw it for what it was. And they said no, and they were complaining and doing all that, and the barons were really the power. So the elector said and got together with the church, and the church came back and said, well, no, wait, you must have misunderstood us. We're not going to alter your liberty of conscience. You can do what you wish. You guys, you few barons here. But it's everybody else we're talking about. You get to be included with the elite. But out there in the catechumen, no more. No more. They will have no more liberty of conscience. Well, it backfired. These barons left, met separately, prepared written document overnight and came back the next day in front of the guy and said, and it was a formal protest. And they addressed that they would not accept the repeal of anything that would take away the liberty of conscience. And so when they wrote it up and described it for the church, they referred to these guys not as defendants, but as protestants. Okay.
Yes.
So, it's been an active, when they do away with the protestants' philosophy, they will be doing away with your right to liberty of conscience. And that's still a goal, believe it or not. That's a Babylonian thing and condition for the esoterics and the elite positions. Now, when you go through the history and bring us all the way to this continent, and you understand what I read last night in the business of the sovereignty and the ecclesiastical sovereignty, when it came over here, we still had denominations who were very dictatorial, and especially in New England. The Puritans were very, very strict. And one guy came from England over there, and he was really a good thinker, but he kind of got caught up in liberty of conscience, and he began to stand up in meetings in New England and tell the people that, whoa, you're acting just like they did back when Martin Luther's day. You're telling us how we are to believe.
Oh, dear.
And he got kicked out of one little community after another. They would expel him. You are no longer welcome around here. So he had to go off and start a little place of his own called the Plantation of Rhode Island.
Uh-huh.
His name was Roger Williams.
Yep.
And he was noted for just an absolutely great interpreter and practicer and practitioner of liberty of conscience. Without it, there would be no Bill of Rights. In other words, he won the day in the long run. People began to understand what he was standing for, and it began to ripple through all the colonies. To where by the time the Revolutionary War came around, or we sat down to prepare the Constitution, it was a principle that was understood. And so it's the liberty of conscience that we are defending. It is the central right. It's the one that permits you to assemble, to speak your mind, to write what you want to in the press. You're beginning to understand where I'm coming from there.
Yes, I am.
All right. So that's my little lecture on life, liberty, and property, and the liberty of conscience. Which one is the most valuable, do you think? The right of property or the right of liberty of conscience?
Well, I go for the liberty of conscience for what I experienced in my life. Although all of our rights hinge around property.
That's correct.
We can't ignore that. But being so free to speak.
It is through the exercise of your liberty of conscience that you do things with your property. I'm going to choose to grow this. But you learn the ability of making decisions in which there are choices and the freedom to do so. Okay?
Yes.
Let's look at these maxims of the law further down. Property rights and possession. And for Timothy, I'm going to read them out kind of slow for you. Everyone is a regulator and disposer of his own property. Any problem with what that's saying?
Nope.
Now, regulator here has a very big significance, and I remember, what does the government produce? Regulations. And you submit to them and accept them with regard to your property?
Yes.
Everyone is... I'm sorry, what?
Nothing. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I'd like to hear what you said.
Well, you said that the regulations and people obey them or don't obey them. You know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Not all of us obey.
You do exercise your liberty of conscience? You must be careful of that, Timothy. It's liable to get you in trouble with them someday.
Yeah, someday and many days, past and present.
Mm-hmm.
I'm learning every day. So.
Long possession produces the right of possession and takes away from the true owner his action.
Wow.
This is squatter's rights.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it's because you've spent a long time putting, in those days, if you were living on the land, you had to work the land. You put a lot of labor and stuff in it to live there that long. And so you are the owner of your labor. Now, there's a thing called Rerum Novarum, which is a new set of rules that is to be implemented, and they have recently been implemented in South Africa.
Really?
Goes like this. Here's how it works. You own your own house, and you pay taxes, and you go away on vacation for 30 days. While you're away, some family comes down the road and notices that your house is empty and they're very poor, and so they decide they are going to break and enter and start living there. When you come back on vacation, Rerum Novarum says it's theirs.
Wow.
They've taken the right of possession and elevated it way beyond any reason. Okay? Now, it's interesting to note that the people who are back from vacation still own it and still owe the taxes.
Mm-hmm.
But they cannot use it. Okay, Rerum Novarum.
How would you spell that?
In whatever is written in the... Oh gosh, I need to ask James Damon. It's Roman. It's Latin.
Okay, it's Latin. I'm looking up.
And go to the Vatican website. It's an edict from the late 1800s, or whatever they call those things that the Pope utters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a portion down in there where it discusses property. To the church, if you read that, to the church, the best form of government is fascism. Anyway, the point is that the right of possession is elevated. And at first when they describe it, it says, well, if you live next door to a guy that got a brand new flat screen, and you don't have one and you can't afford one, you can go over and take his. And it really is designed to reduce the catechumen to true slaves. They don't want the independent of thought or the liberty of conscience. All right. That which is mine cannot be lost, transferred to another, or taken away without my own act, consent, or forfeiture. Now, that certainly makes a lot of sense, and that's I don't have a problem understanding that one, do you?
No, not at all.
How about you, Timothy? Okay. Next one. The right of property is that sole and despotic dominion which one man claims and exercises over the external things in the world, in total exclusion of the right of any other individual. How is that for a statement?
Which claims exercises external things in the world?
The man.
Well, is his castle? Yes.
You can defend it. You have the right of self-defense to defend your property. And no man is compelled to sell his own property even for a just price. You see, what that's saying is you cannot be compelled to enter into a contract. Because you're not going to sell it without a contract. To record the change of ownership and all that will require all those contractual things. So no man is compelled to enter into a contract, even for a just price. Well, they said I had to get a social security number to work.
Well, that was a lie.
Compelled. Yeah. Well, the trouble is you couldn't get a job. They used third-party enforcement.
Well, that's the.
They allow the third parties to commit the crimes. Yes.
So whoever, like, I'm actually looking at a W-4 form right now that my employer wants me to fill out. And he doesn't have to. I don't, you know, I've actually spoken to the owner of the company I work for about these things. And, you know, he's a little confused. You know, he doesn't want to.
Oh.
I mean, it's the same thing as like contracting out, really. You're contracting out your labor, right? You're working for him, and he's agreed to pay you. So, but what the pressure comes from the government or the IRS to his company, who wouldn't care? He does it all the time. He hires contractors, and he 1099, gives them 1099 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I fill this out, then I did the contract. That means, you know, where people are is trying to fight the IRS. Once you sign that W-4 form, you give their consent for them to take money out of your paycheck. If you don't sign it, you don't give it, then there is no contract.
No,
so
but
my
go ahead.
My labor is my property.
That's correct.
And I believe that there is a Supreme Court decision that says people cannot be taxed for their labor, but somehow they still do, but only through the contract.
Well,
so,
everybody acquiesces.
Yeah.
Oh.
Nobody.
So that's my dilemma today. Is, you know, I don't want to sign this contract. You know.
Well, on the W-4, when you get to your when you finish your properly commenced judicial proceeding, remember that is for the all caps legal entity anyway.
Right.
That's not for you as a human.
Well, it is.
And they're wanting you to.
I mean, I'm still contracted with them, so I have my license.
No, this is the hardest thing to teach.
Oh, yeah.
The all caps name, what is it, is a legal entity.
Right.
It is an unrecorded single member corporation. It is not a living, breathing human being. It is a legal fiction.
Right, I understand that.
Okay?
Yeah.
And if you wish, when you get to where you master this thing, you will sign it by printing the all caps name.
Yeah. I did that with the power of attorney.
You understand now. When you're in that, because we're unraveling it. We have to do it, but we'll never get it unraveled.
So if I just, my signature is an all capital letter spelled out.
Yes. All you're doing is saying for the legal entity. Okay? Let me tell you, the first time I did this, I was dealing with this corporation and they, people all kind of bailed out me on me, and I was the only officer there. And came to income tax time, and they filled out the income tax form and they brought it in to me, and it says authorized agent or taxpayer. I'm sorry, it said it the other way: taxpayer or authorized agent.
Okay.
And I said, well, wait a minute. And I'm sitting there, vice president of this organization was the taxpayer, so on that line, and honest, I did this. I just printed the name of the company, the taxpayer.
Well, that's what they're supposed to be. Corporations can be taxed.
Yes, but I signed it as the name of the company. Therefore, my name did not appear on there as authorized agent. And I sent it in. And it was accepted. So I did it again and again. So then I tried it on sales tax forms for the state. And they accepted it. They accepted it. They accepted it.
Question. When you sign your name as all capital letters and print it as all capital letters, do you put brackets or anything around it?
What do you mean you signed your name?
No. When you printed your name in all capital letters.
Stop. I got to stop you, William. And this is the trick. This is how you trick yourself. Whose name is it?
Okay, the authorized agent taxpayer. When the taxpayer printed his name in all capital letters.
You didn't put brackets around it because you wanted it to be on the paper.
Don't put brackets around it, okay?
But your pronouns, it's you convict yourself.
Correct. I see.
Anything when the legal entity's name is put on here, do I put brackets around it? No. Not necessary. Is that making sense to you?
Yes, no brackets for taxpayer. Leave the legal entity.
Yeah.
That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, but don't get down that deep. You don't have to go down into the bracket thing. It's not you, it's the legal entity.
I just need to get it clarified so I get rid of the old memory.
Okay, but the answer is it's not you.
Mm-hmm.
It is not you. Has nothing to do with brackets. That is they want the taxpayer. Now, if you were to sign your name, you are saying you are the authorized representative. And that would give you a nexus in that situation where they even may come and try to collect 941 taxes from you that were due to corporation they'll pay. It's very, it's horribly bad. But recognize that the taxpayer is the name of the entity. Recognize that the driver is the name of the entity. Recognize that the man that got married is the entity.
Mm-hmm.
You follow me? You're getting to understand
yes.
What I'm trying to tell you.
Yes, is the name of the entity. I'm writing this down.
Equal twin.
So all
of that stuff. And we have to pay for it. Yeah.
Okay. And you must understand that it's the way my mentor would handle this. I'd bring the sign and say, I got to sign this. He'd say, whose papers are they? I'd say they're mine. And then I'd, he'd let me go for a minute. He wouldn't answer my question. He'd say, look, I got to take care of this. Bring it back in a minute. I'd bring it back, and I'd say, go through it again. He'd say, well, whose papers are they?
Brilliant.
What do you mean they're your papers? I have to sign. Who has to sign this? Until you get that mental discipline straight, you'll never know the game they played on you. They're always talking to the legal entity. They can talk to no one else.
That's right.
Oh.
So then you're justified for every single document with the federal government in writing the taxpayer's name out in caps. Regardless of who it is, if you suspect that there's trickery involved.
Well, I don't even go that far. I mean, it's the idea that you're the legal entity they're looking for.
Now, what would have happened if I had tried that with my driver's license for Texas, for instance?
It'd have been, what do you mean? Do you tell them?
No, I mean, would that require a signature? No, I just...
Would you tell them? Hey, do you mind if I sign this as a legal entity? No, just recognize that that's what it's for, and then wait till there's an issue. Well, is that your signature? No, that's the legal entity's name.
Well, okay, but you still have to pay for it. It's not worth it. All right.
Yeah, you pay and you live. You walk the path that's the least chaotic. That's consistent with Christian principle. But last night, many of the questions centered around people not understanding this, and
correct.
The properly commenced judicial proceeding is formalizing your relationship, and it's bringing you, the real person, into the creditor position and not being confused with an accommodator who's being signed on to cover the debtor's debts as a surety, which was not disclosed to you. And the magic comes when you finally learn to master this with an understanding and a confidence, and you never slip up. Oh, you want the entity's name on here. Only though you say that to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they went further in the papers you filed, Timothy. You got that entity to give you, the human, a power of attorney to sign for him, okay? Now the trouble,
no.
Huh?
Go ahead, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
In that stack of papers, you signed as the power of attorney. And this whole process we're talking about is about property. The recovery of the control of the equity interest in your property.
Okay.
So it's proper that we're talking about it in this maxim session.
I have a question.
When I had it notarized, the notary was like very confused about what
happened. Oh, yeah.
I printed out the name in blue, and then I signed my name.
Yes. Well, tell him that's legal entity. But I kind of interrupted myself, so I'm trying to collect my thoughts. When you are, the power of attorney, the entity issued a power of attorney to the creditor. And the creditor is now the authorized representative for the entity. So you actually could sign that with your regular signature with the dash and the colon, which is proper English, incidentally.
Dash, colon.
Dash between the names, colon before the last name.
I see.
The before the surname, not last name. Surname.
The name.
Signed. You have to add the letters A-R after it.
A-R.
You're the authorized representative for that entity.
Small letters or capital letters?
Capital
A-R.
A-R. But you should see it in the papers. If you deal with the papers, you should see them.
Okay, well, I have...
Now, the problem with that is... Hello?
Yes.
The problem with that is, to use the power of attorney, you should include a copy of the document that gives you power of attorney. And people forget to do that.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Let's suppose you were authorized to sign for Will Rankin's house on a sale for with the power of attorney that he's given you. When you go to the closing, you think those closing officers are going to accept you just sitting there and saying, well, I got his power of attorney.
Well, you have to have
and you're going to sign Timothy Foley. Okay. Got it?
Right.
So by what authority do you say you have the power of attorney? By this one where he gave it to me. So you have to learn how to make transactions that depend upon power of attorney. You have to know how to not create a great big kerfuffle when you sign as the entity. Because it's necessary to keep peace.
I have a question, if I may.
Yep.
This year, sometime in June, I think, I'm going to have to renew my driver's license or somehow finish the entire process for the secured party creditor.
So I'm using every opportunity I can to teach this distinction between the surety, the entity, and the soul, the human soul, the man who is the sovereign and the one who speaks to God and the one who is the priest and king.
Mm-hmm. I would like to ask you a question. Remember the very first announcement you made about the woman in North Carolina who used the warrant and ended up in trouble?
Yeah, I don't have any evidence.
Okay, but nevertheless, such things are typical nowadays. As you know, I just purchased these DVDs, and I'm trying to hold meetings for people who want to sit in on it and learn the secured party creditor procedure, et cetera. Except that it's not something that can be learned and practiced overnight or accomplished overnight. I'm going to have to renew a driver's license, and I'm not willing to risk going to jail with the way my life is at this point, even if it's just for overnight.
Well, who gets the driver's license?
Well, that's what I'm going to phrase. The entity does.
All right.
Now, keep in mind, I haven't taken the course. I'm not too clear on all the language, but this was my question. As a temporary measure, when I went to renew my license and filled out the application, if I wrote my correction, if the entity wrote his name in all capital letters in the place of signature, that would be a compromise, which would be a legal compromise until I can get all of the ducks in a row, so to speak, and fulfill all the requirements for a secured party creditor. Does this make any sense to do things that way?
Well, I've never, I don't think, personally, I would do it. Why lie to them?
That's a good point. Why lie to them?
Mm-hmm. Remember, these are all done under penalty of perjury.
Oh, boy. You're great. So the entity prints his name on the penalty of perjury.
Right.
Already things have been in to make sense.
Okay, are we done with the session?
I guess so.
Okay. You want
I would like to hear input from Tim.